Chapter 23. The crew of the Sea Rover wasted no time in making preparations to investigate the submerged target. Captain Morgan brought the ship around and positioned it directly above the target, using the GPS coordinates identified by Audrey. Computerized side thrusters on the research vessel were activated, and the Sea Rover was parked in place, constantly self-adjusting its position against the wind and current with the thrusters to remain fixed within a few inches of the designated mark. On the aft deck, Dirk, Summer, and First Officer Ryan carefully walked through a pre-dive checklist for the Starfish. Specifically designed for deep water scientific exploration, the Starfish was a high-tech submersible capable of operating in depths up to 2,000 meters. Resembling a giant translucent ball on a forklift, the Starfish carried two operators in a 6-inch thick reinforced acrylic bubble that offered a panoramic view of the sea. Wedged into a bright orange supporting buttress, the see-through sphere was filled with a myriad of sensors, still and video cameras, and coring devices. Four sets of adjustable thrusters were mounted behind and beneath the bubble, which provided the sub with a high degree of maneuverability. Adding to the functionality were a pair of steel articulating arms mounted on either side of the bubble, which could be used for collecting samples and manipulating the multiple data analysis devices. Since the right mechanical arm was larger in size than the left, the whole submersible took on a crab-like appearance when operating on the seafloor. "I think we're set," Summer said, eyeing the last item on her clipboard. "You ready to get wet?" "Only if I get to drive," Dirk grinned back. Clad in aqua-colored Numa jumpsuits, the two siblings threaded their way into the tiny chamber through a hatch in the rear. Though cramped inside, Dirk and Summer sat comfortably in a pair of padded captain's chairs, which faced out the front of the acrylic bubble. Dirk slipped on a communications headset and spoke to First Officer Ryan. "This is Starfish," he said, checking the system. "Ready when you are, Tim." "Prepare for deployment," Ryan's voice rang back. An overhead boom reeled up a thick cable attached to the submersible by a pair of eyelets, raising the underwater vessel straight into the air and suspending her 3 feet above the deck. As the Starfish hung floating in the air, Ryan pushed a button on a side console, and the deck suddenly split open beneath the submersible, sliding on rollers to either side of the deck. Exposed beneath the dangling submersible was the pale green water of the East China Sea. Ryan hit another switch, and a circular band of underwater floodlights burst on, outlining the perimeter of the large moon pool cut into the Sea Rover's rear hull section. A large meandering grouper was caught illuminated by the sudden flash of light and quickly bolted from beneath the odd hole in the ship's hull. The orange submersible was slowly dropped through the hole and into the water, the lifting cable released after Dirk confirmed that all systems were operational aboard the Starfish. "Cable is released," Ryan's voice announced over Dirk's headset. "You are free to swim. Happy hunting, guys." "Thanks for the drop," Dirk answered. "I'll honk the horn when we get back from the store." Dirk tested the thrusters one last time as Summer opened a ballast tank, allowing a flood of salt water to fill the chamber. Negative buoyancy was quickly achieved, and the submersible began slowly dropping into the depths. The pale green water gradually dissolved to brown, then faded to an inky black as the Starfish sank deeper. Summer flicked on a switch, and a powerful bank of xenon arc lights illuminated their path, though there was little to see in the murky water. Dependent on gravity to reach the bottom, it took about 15 minutes to make the nearly 1,000-foot descent to the sea floor. Despite the frigid water temperatures outside, the occupants soon became warm from the electronic equipment churning about them in the insulated acrylic, and Summer finally turned on an air conditioning unit to keep themselves cool. Attempting to make the time go faster, Dirk rehashed a few of Jack Dahlgren's stale jokes, while Summer brought her brother up to date on the sea pollutant survey taken off Japan's eastern coast. At 900 feet, Summer began tweaking the buoyancy level to slow their descent and avoid smacking hard on the bottom. Dirk noticed the water visibility had cleared, though the seas were devoid of much life at that depth. Gradually through the murk, he eyed a familiar dark shape looming up beneath them. "There she is. We're right on her." The shadowy black superstructure of the I-411's conning tower reached out to them like a tiny skyscraper as the starfish descended amidships of the giant submarine. Much like he had found with the I-403, Dirk observed that the I-411 was sitting upright on the bottom, tilted at just a 15-degree angle. Surface encrustation was much less severe than on the I-403, and the big sub looked as if she had only been underwater a few months, not years. Dirk activated the starfish's thrusters and backed away slightly from the approaching vessel, while Summer adjusted their buoyancy to remain neutral at 960 feet, just even with the submarine's deck. "She's enormous," Summer exclaimed as her eyes took in the sub's huge girth. Even with Starfish's bright lights, she could only see a portion of the entire vessel. "Definitely not your run-of-the-mill World War II U-boat," he replied. "Let's see where she got hit." Maneuvering the thrusters, Dirk propelled the submersible along a path down the starboard flank of the submarine, gliding just a few feet above its rounded topsides. Circling around the stern, Summer pointed out the tips of the I-411's two giant bronze propellers poking out of the muddy bottom. Moving forward along the port side, they traveled about 50 feet before a huge gash appeared at the waterline. "Torpedo hit number one," Dirk called out, eyeing the fatal impact from one of the swordfish's torpedoes. He positioned the starfish so that its lights shined into the irregular opening. Inside, a circular mass of twisted and jagged metal shined back at them, like the open jaws of an iron-toothed shark. Turning and moving forward again, the submersible crept along the silent wreck another 30 feet before a second opening appeared. "Torpedo hit number two," Dirk said. Unlike the first gash on the port flank, the second hole was oddly centered higher up, along the edge of the topside deck, almost as if the explosive force had been delivered from above. "You're right. This must have been the second torpedo impact," Summer speculated. "The stern must have already dropped under from the first hit, and the sub rolled back from the initial recoil when the second torpedo hit her here. Pretty good firing from the swordfish. They must have caught her at night while she was running on the surface." "Is that the aircraft hangar?" Summer asked, pointing to a large tubular appendage that ran lengthwise along the rear deck to the conning tower. "Yes. Looks like it was blasted open in the explosion," he said as they glided over towards the opening. A 20-foot section of the hangar adjacent to the deck had simply disappeared in the carnage. Under the beam of the floodlights, they could see a 3-bladed aircraft propeller mounted on the backside of the hangar wall as they floated outside, peering in. Applying power to the thrusters, Dirk turned the vehicle and zoomed forward, gliding past the I-411's conning tower with its multiple gun platforms still in place. The starfish proceeded down the forward deck before turning and hovering off the bow near one of the large diving planes, which sprouted off the submarine like a giant wing. "That concludes the scenic portion of the tour," Dirk said. "Let's see if we can find out what she carried." "We better check in with the gang upstairs first," Summer said, slipping on her communications headset and pushing the transmit button. "Sea Rover, this is Starfish. We've found the Easter Bunny and are proceeding to hunt for the eggs."
"Roger," Ryan's voice crackled back. "Be careful with the basket."
"I think he's more concerned about his submersible than he is about us," Dirk deadpanned. "A typical man," Summer mused, shaking her head. "Places emotional feelings on inanimate mechanical objects."
"I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about," Dirk replied facetiously.
As he spoke, he gently guided the starfish above the submarine's bow section, studying the forward deck. After several minutes, he spotted what he was looking for. "There's the forward hatch to the upper torpedo room. If they followed suit with the I-403, that's where the biological ordnance would have been loaded and stored." Dirk maneuvered the starfish in front of the hatch before setting the submersible down onto the deck of the I-411 and killing the thrusters.
"How's your breaking and entering skills?" he asked of Summer.
Unlike on the I-403, the forward hatch was closed and battened tight by a flush-mounted wheel. Summer activated a joystick control hidden in the armrest of her chair and powered the hydraulics to the submersible's right retractable arm. As she manipulated the controls, the metal appendage sprang from the side of Starfish and extended forward in a clumsy stretch.
Slowly, she dropped the arm down towards the hatch, adjusting the toggle control with short flips to maneuver the device. With the precision of a surgeon, she opened the claw-like hand and dropped it down to the hatch, wedging the fingers into the open slots of the hatch wheel on the first attempt. "Nicely done," Dirk admired. "Now, if she'll just open," Summer replied. With the flick of a second toggle control, the articulated grip of the mechanical claw began to twist. Dirk and Summer both pressed their faces to the bubble window, intent on seeing the wheel turn. But the seal that had been locked for 60 years didn't budge. Summer tried toggling the grip back and forth a half dozen more times, but to no avail. "So much for my hydraulic grip," she finally muttered. "Keep a hold on the wheel," Dirk instructed. "We'll try a little leverage." In an instant, he powered up the thrusters and lifted the starfish a few inches off the deck. With Summer gripping the hatch wheel with the claw, Dirk applied full reverse thrust and tried to break the seal with the momentum of the entire submersible. The wheel held tight, so he began rocking the starfish forwards and backwards, trying to get a quick burst of leverage against the hatch. "I think you're going to rip the arm off," Summer cautioned. With silent determination, he kept trying. On the next tug, he observed a barely perceptible movement in the wheel. Another blast and the seal broke at last, the wheel jerking a quarter spin. "That's showing it who's boss," Summer said. "Just don't tell Ryan that his baby's right arm is now a few inches longer than it used to be," Dirk smiled. Hovering over the hatch, Summer was quickly able to spin the locking wheel to its stops with the articulated claw. Dirk then backed the starfish away, and with Summer holding on, the hatch finally swung up and open. Repositioning the submersible in front of the opening, they peered into the hole, but could see nothing but a black void. "I guess this is a job for Snoopy." "You have the controls," Summer said. Dirk pulled out a laptop control module and pressed the power on button. A row of lights lit up green as the unit was activated. "Ready? Go fetch," he murmured while pressing a toggle switch that engaged a tiny thruster. From an external cradle tucked beneath the acrylic bubble popped out a small, tethered, remote-operated vehicle. No larger than an attaché case, the tiny ROV was little more than a self-illuminated video camera wedged against a small set of electronic thrusters. Able to probe and prod into tight spaces, Snoopy was an ideal tool for exploring the deep and dangerous niches of a submerged wreck. Summer watched as Snoopy sprang into view and quickly ducked into the open hatch amidst a spray of small bubbles. Dirk punched another console button and a live video feed from the ROV appeared on a color monitor. Watching the monitor to steer, he guided the vehicle around the now familiar torpedo room. Snoopy skirted down one row of torpedoes where the camera showed all five of the huge steel fish still resting in their racks. Circling to the other side of the bay, a duplicate scene was replayed on the opposite side of the torpedo room. The I-411 was clearly not anticipating battle when the swordfish surprised and sank her. But Dirk wasn't interested in torpedoes. Methodically, he drove Snoopy to the prow of the torpedo room, then systematically swept the ROV back and forth across the bay, slipping a few feet towards the stern with each pass until he was satisfied that every square foot had been viewed. No sign of the canisters or their crates. But there is a second torpedo room below, where they could have been stored. "Can you get Snoopy down there?" Summer asked. "There's a floor hatch for loading the torpedoes, but I don't think Snoopy is going to lift that open. I may know of another route." Scanning the room with Snoopy's camera lens eye, he spotted the rear hatch door that led to the chief's quarters. The hatch door was still open, and Dirk maneuvered the ROV through it a few seconds later. "Over there," Summer said, motioning to a corner of the monitor. "There's a ladder that looks like it leads to the deck below." Dirk danced the ROV around a mass of debris and down an open hatchway in the floor. Dropping down to the deck below, Snoopy sniffed out the doorway to the lower torpedo room and entered the second bay of warheads. Though slightly smaller due to the more tapered sides of the submarine's hull, the bay was an exact duplicate of the torpedo room above it.
And just as they had seen once before, the camera showed all 10 of the deadly Type 95 torpedoes resting peacefully in their racks. Though near the limit of the self-coiling tether that provided Snoopy its power, Dirk carefully maneuvered the ROV around the full confines of the room. The camera showed a full complement of torpedoes in the bay, but nothing else. The empty room glared back at them vacantly. "It would appear," Summer said, shaking her head with disappointment, "that there are no eggs to be had."